DW Spectrum with Connor Dillon.
Say, woman, what's this stuff you cooking? Now that meat and no potatoes are just seen right there like a green tomato.
Here I'm waiting, palpitating with all that meat
and no potato.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon, and yep, all that meat and no potatoes. You'll find dishes like that in a lot of homes around the world. Other people wishing for less meat in some homes. Some people trying to reduce or increase the amount of vegetables they're eating. And, you know, it's January. It's the beginning of the year. And at the very least, you can say it's a good time to stop and think about the food that we put on our plates and whether we should eat it or not, and to kind of dip into some food science. And with that in mind, I am joined in studio by my DW colleague, Sam Baker. Sam, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Toward the end of last year, in December of last year, there was some big news about lab-grown meat.
Yeah.
And it involved steak.
Yes. So a company based in Israel created the first piece of steak that brings together different types of cells, so fat cells and muscle cells, and they created this in the lab. So other types of meat have been created in the lab, but they haven't had multiple types of cells in them.
Okay, so multiple kinds of cells in the steak. Does it look like steak? Does it look like something you'd want to eat at a restaurant?
I don't think it looks like what you'd picture getting a big steak at a restaurant would look like. It was maybe, I think they said it was 5 millimeters thick, so very thin, pretty small. It maybe would be like a couple bites at most.
I was going to say 5 millimeters is like a cracker, like yeah. A wafer.
Yeah, kind of the shape of like a medium to largish cracker.
Okay, so a very small piece of steak, but a meaningful piece of steak. Now, can I eat this steak in 2019? Is that a realistic scenario?
I don't think you can. While there are a handful of companies out there that are producing these meats made in labs, you know, they need to go through quite a few regulatory processes, and they really need to perfect the ability to grow these meats in the lab at scale that they could get these on the market. So I think we're still a couple years off from seeing those in restaurants and grocery stores, but...
And just real quick, for those of our listeners who haven't been following the lab-grown meat process, where did it start? And yeah, how far have we come?
Yeah, so it actually started a couple decades ago. NASA looked into this as a way to have meat and seafood in space for their astronauts, but they didn't really get around to creating a viable end product.
Meaning you would just grow the meat up in the International Space Station rather than hauling a slaughtered cow.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so if you're up there for long periods of time, you could continue to produce meat, essentially. So the first kind of successful meat material made in a lab was a hamburger in 2013, and that came out of Maastricht University in the Netherlands. And so that was a burger. It wasn't very flavorful from what the scientists said, and it cost €250,000 to produce.
That's a really expensive burger.
Very expensive, yep. So, which is pretty common, especially when you're talking about dealing with stem cells in a lab and all their research and development.
And those stem cells came from a cow.
Yep, they came from a cow. So they take stem cells out of a cow via kind of a biopsy process. So it doesn't harm the cow in any way. And then they take those cells in the lab and they grow them in an environment to kind of coax them into being muscle or fat cells or whatever they want.
So some of our listeners are probably asking why at this point, because you can, you know, rather than spending €250,000 on a burger, you can spend about 99 cents at certain fast food restaurants. So why go through all this trouble to grow this stuff in a lab?
Yeah, so livestock production takes up a large amount of space in the world, uses a lot of resources like water, and it also gives off quite a bit of greenhouse gas from rearing the livestock and, you know, their flatulence even, to moving that meat across the world to bring it to consumers. So all in all, that adds a lot to our greenhouse gas emissions and contributes to climate change. So if we could find a way to do this in a lab and cut down on some of that resource use and greenhouse gas emissions, it would be better for the environment.
Now, I know a lot of people, and I suspect you might be one of them, they're trying to reduce their meat consumption to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases emitted as a result. But that's just maybe, I don't know, here in Germany, that's kind of a thing. How's it look elsewhere in the world? Are people cutting back on meat? Is meat consumption expected to go up?
I think for people who are aware of those environmental impacts, people might be reducing their meat a little bit, whether that's one day a week not having meat or becoming vegetarian. And yes, that's my New Year's resolution this year. We'll see how it goes.
To become a full-on vegetarian.
Yep, to go full-on vegetarian. I don't eat a lot of meat anyway, but occasionally when I'm out at restaurants, I do, and just to cut back on that. Yeah, but worldwide, meat consumption is going up. Our population is growing, especially countries like China and India. Their appetite for meat is increasing as they kind of move up the income scale, you know, across the world. So it's projected that by 2050, so in 3 decades, meat consumption will increase by 70%. So that's a lot more livestock or for meat.
So let's go into some of the, I mean, all of this is theoretical. There's not much meat actually being produced in labs at this point, but some of the potential benefits from lab-grown meat that might not be expected or known about at this point. So there's the greenhouse gases that are being saved. What other side or corollary benefits are there in producing this stuff in a lab?
I talked to 2 companies that are doing this, one based in the UK and one based in Israel. And both of them really stress that something that's not talked about as much are the health, potential health benefits from lab-grown meat. So when you're growing those cells in a lab, you can manipulate how many fat cells you want in a cut of meat, or maybe what types of fats they are, you know, saturated versus unsaturated, or adding omega-3s. So you can play around with that a bit, which has great benefits for especially countries that may be dealing with obesity issues and want to cut back on some of that fat.
It's odd to think about meat that way, that you can, you know, it raises the question of what is meat? If you can manipulate all these factors and begin changing it, at what point is meat not meat? But I guess we can.
Yeah, but I mean, you think about other types of meat, like when I used to live in Alaska, there was a lot of caribou meat, and that's really lean. So people would choose to eat that as opposed to hamburger. So it's kind of a matter of choices in some sense.
Well, and what about antibiotics? Wouldn't be used? You wouldn't have to shoot antibiotics into a hunk of meat in a lab.
Yep. So you're not pumping animals with antibiotics as well as hormones, which are both pretty common in kind of industrial scale farming today. And the other benefit to growing meat in a lab is you're not dealing with slaughterhouses, which is often where bacteria can creep into meat. So salmonella, E. coli, those things wouldn't really exist in a sterilized lab.
Well, and not to mention potential pandemics that fortunately haven't happened yet.
Yeah.
Would be less likely to occur.
Well, yeah, you could also kind of control for things like mad cow disease. Obviously, you would make sure the stem cells you're using don't come from cows with certain diseases.
So you're trying to be a vegetarian in 2019.
Yep.
Would you eat, if someone were to put some lab-grown meat in front of you right now, would you eat that?
Definitely. I mean, mostly for the novelty of trying it. But I think, yeah, the concerns in terms of environmental impacts, animal welfare issues, like those aren't there with lab-grown meat. So, I mean, I like the taste of meat. I'd definitely go back to it if it was an option.
Okay. So, again, it sounds like 2019 might not be the year that this all happens, but do we have a rough time frame for when, I don't know, we can put our barbecues outside, fire them up, and then put a huge cut of lab-grown steak on for a reasonable price?
Yeah, so it sounds like it's going to take about another 2 years for the research and development stage of things. So even though these companies are producing meat, they still have a ways to go in perfecting it. And then maybe another 2 years for it to get into restaurants and maybe higher-end grocery stores. And then some folks I talked to outside of these companies said, realistically, for it to be in a mainstream grocery store, we're still probably looking at 5 to 10 years.
Okay, 5 to 10 years. So 2019... isn't the year of lab-grown meat, but at least we know it's kind of on the horizon and it's coming, and maybe people can cut down on meat consumption between now and then. Sam Baker, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All that meat and no potatoes. All that food to the alligators.
Now hold me steady, I'm really ready. Now all that meat and no potatoes.
I am hungry for some lab-grown meat after listening to that song and talking to Sam Baker. We are going to stick to the topic of health for the moment. And I'm going to preface this next report by mentioning a study that is ongoing and happening right now here in the Rhineland, which is an area in Western Germany. And the idea is to get 30,000 people to come in for regular checkups to see if, you know, they're healthy, obviously, but also just to monitor how their bodies change over time, whether they're getting healthier in certain areas or unhealthier in others, and in general, how their lifestyles impact their long-term health. And I've always felt kind of bad because I actually met the woman who is in charge of that Rhineland study. I met her at the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases here in Bonn, Germany. And she asked me during that interview, hey, are you, you know, would you participate? And I said, yes, I would. I would be interested in doing that. I've never gotten around to doing it. And I really meant it when I said it. And I still want to do it. I've just never done it. But the good thing is, I have a colleague in Berlin. Her name is Tamsin Walker. And Tamsin is participating in a much larger scale variation of the same idea. And for more on that, we go to Tamsin in Berlin.
It's taken me many years of living in Germany, where doctors can be found on every other street corner and pharmacies brightly advertise sickness, to understand the seriousness of the relationship between the population and its health. And it's taken me just as many years of listening to colourful tales about runny noses and bottoms, fungal feet, scratchy throats, bacteria, drafts, more bacteria, and colon massages, to accept that bodily malfunction is very much a part of public discourse. As one who was brought up in a climate of tough love where physical niggles weren't indulged gladly and a day off school wasn't granted easily, I'm still sometimes bewildered by this national obsession. And when my children come home and say their teachers are going to have a cold for the next fortnight, my question is invariably, how can they be so sure? But what would a health Grinch like me know? And besides, a caring society with an established healthcare system is surely something to appreciate rather than malign. Because sniffles and tickles aside, there's no knowing who will be struck by what illness, when. And as a friend who died from cancer last year philosophically told me shortly after her diagnosis, it's less a case of why me than why not me.
Also, herzlich willkommen erstmal. Mein Name ist Kusnitz. Ich möchte Sie hier heute untersuchen. Und bevor wir jetzt anfangen können, müssen wir einmal zusammen die Einwilligung durchgehen.
Okay. So when I got a letter asking if I'd agree to take part in the most far-reaching national health study ever conducted in Germany, I signed up. NARCO, as the publicly funded research is called, seeks, through the long-term observation of 200,000 adults in all states of the country and of health, to better understand the risk factors for a whole rack of known serious illnesses, including cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and Alzheimer's.
Achtung, fertig, los. Eins, zwei, drei.
In analysing interviews, answers to extensive questionnaires, samples of bodily fluids, and the results of physical examinations, the NARCO team hopes to gain an insight into how environmental, geographical, and socioeconomic factors play into our physical well-being, and thereby help improve risk prediction and ultimately prevent illness.
Dann bitte ab hier, ab jetzt. Blau, grün, blau, gelb, rot.
On that basis, I submitted myself to prods and probes that tested things like arm strength, lung capacity, and physical fitness, and measured parts of my body in ways I'd not thought possible, and my mind in others painfully reminiscent of maths class nightmares.
Vogel, Stange, Karte, Brief, Butter, Arm, Strand, Königin, Gras, Teller, Motor, Hütte.
Ja, super, sehr gut.
Because repeating a sequence of six numbers in reverse order against the clock will never be my forte. By way of compensation, though, they said I have a solid grasp of words. I'll settle for that. Although, because of the long-term nature of this study, it's likely to benefit my kids or even their kids more than myself. I like the idea of being able to contribute to health research in a country which, though I may sometimes consider overly attentive to minor ailments, I'm pretty sure will be there for me as and when I need it.
Results.
I've since received the outcome of my tests. There was a discreet lack of reference to my numerical disaster, but enough other information to suggest I'm not falling apart. Yet. But there was also evidence that though I cycle for several hours a week, rarely go anywhere by car, walk up and down hundreds of stairs every day, and only really sit down when I'm working, I'm not getting enough exercise. So if you'll excuse me, I'm going for a run.
DW.
I saw the crescent. You saw the whole of the moon. The whole of the moon.
The whole of the moon, it's something we don't see very often, at least not, definitely not with the naked eye. Standing here on Earth, there's exactly one side of the moon that we typically see. And yet recently there was news of a probe seeing the other side in a way that apparently we hadn't seen before. Now, with me on the line is Dirk Lorenzen. Dirk is a trained physicist. He's also a journalist with Deutschlandfunk here in Germany. And Dirk, let's go ahead and start with that news piece as we discuss the big things that are going to happen in 2019. Let's start with the moon here and this quote-unquote dark side of the moon that a Chinese probe has landed on. Why is that such a big deal? Why is that so important?
Yeah, it's, well, we always call it the dark side of the moon, but actually it's the far side of the moon. So that's this part of the moon that we can never see from Earth. So the moon is always facing us, this one side, the near side. And so right until now, or until last week, so we just had, well, some pictures made by satellites orbiting the moon. And now it's the first time that a probe has landed on the far side of the moon. So the Chinese will provide us with new insight on this, well, quite unknown territory of the moon.
So let me play devil's advocate just for a second here. Now, we've had spacecraft circling the moon and getting information about this far side of the moon for quite some time. So why is it such a big deal that there's a probe on there?
Because there is a, well, the biggest impact structure we have in the solar system is on the far side of the moon. So it's scientifically very interesting to go to this specific site where the Chinese have landed, their Chang'e 4 lander. And in this impact site, so we have lots of material just lying on the surface that was originally inside the moon. So, well, the scientists get probes, material probes just from deep into the interior of the moon, just on the surface. So it's very exciting to study that, to learn something about its composition. And the long-term goal is to learn how the moon was formed, from which material it is made of, and to learn something about the formation of the moon and all the planets. And that means to learn something about the history of Earth as well.
So the Chang'e 4 probe is going to let us look, in a way, deeper into the moon than we ever have before?
Yeah. And the nice part is nature is providing the material from deep inside the moon for free because it was a huge impact billion years ago, creating these huge impact structure with a diameter of more than 2,000 kilometers. And so now all the material that was excavated back then during this huge impact billion years ago is still lying on the surface, and just scientists need to go there and to study it. And unfortunately, it's on the far side of the moon. And this is why the first time the Chinese have opted to land on the far far side, which is, as I said, scientifically very interesting. But it's really quite difficult to go there because you don't have any radio contact with Earth. So they have a relay satellite put into a place quite far behind the moon in order to get all the scientific data from Chang'e 4 and to get all the commands to Chang'e 4.
Now, on Twitter and on Facebook, when I was looking at how people were discussing this landing, it kind of felt like a Sputnik moment. A lot of people were kind of freaking out, at least in the, let's say, the Western world. Fans of NASA were kind of feeling like, well, we're losing the race. You know, China is beating us when it comes to the moon. Is China beating us?
No, this is ridiculous. I mean, NASA could do that, or the Russians could do that, or the Europeans could do that. I mean, China has a very nice lunar program. So they go step by step, and we will see some probes, even material probes they bring back to Earth. So China is playing on the same level as Russia and the US, but this is true for more than 10 years now. And I wouldn't say it's really a Sputnik moment. Probably this is, well, to some extent, exaggerated by the social media. And of course, we see some hype here. It's a very exciting mission, and it just shows China is able to do great missions to the moon, but there is a lot of international collaboration as well. So I wouldn't say it's a Sputnik moment.
Okay, so a lot of people are very excited about upcoming Mars missions, but is it fair to say that 2019 is kind of the year of the moon? Are other things in store for us when it comes to the moon this year?
Absolutely. So this is the year of the moon. And of course, to some extent, because we will see the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. So just in July. So, and of course, all the NASA experts will look back quite wistfully to the late 60s, early 70s, when they had this major lunar program. So of course, we will have the celebrations connected to Apollo 11 and the first landing of humans on the moon. But there is even another mission going to the moon. This time, it's not China, it's India. And India will launch in late January or early February its Chandrayaan 2 space probe. That's the second mission to the moon. It consists of an orbiter, a lander, and a rover. So the orbiter will circle the moon and will make studies from orbit. And the lander is going to touch down on the near side of the moon, close to the, well, not close, but in higher latitudes on the southern hemisphere, so close to the south polar region, and will study the composition of the rocks and will make some pictures from the surface. And, well, India is doing this mission in order to, well, gain experience in spaceflight missions and, of course, to learn something more about the moon.
We were talking about the quote-unquote dark side of the moon, or the far side. Now, most areas of the moon are sometimes in light and sometimes in shadow. Is that south pole always going to get sunlight for that Indian mission?
No, the Indian mission is not really going to the South Pole, but it's going to the South Pole region. But you refer to the few peaks of eternal light, as they are called. So there are a few mountains right at the South Pole, or very close to the South Pole on the moon, that are always lit by sunlight. And those peaks of eternal light, as the astronomers call them, they are, of course, very attractive to put their future missions in order to get solar power all month long. Usually on the moon, you have 2 weeks of sunlight, and then you have 2 weeks of, well, pitch darkness. It's black, it's cold, it's really horrible to have a lunar night. And of course, for future missions, the spaceflight engineers want to avoid that, and then you need to go to these peaks of eternal light. But for that, you need a very precise landing, and so far, no nation can do that. So India is going close to the South Pole, but not really to the South Pole.
Now, I love looking at the moon with my telescope, but of course, 2019 has a lot more than just moon stuff in store for us. So, Dirk, could you kind of highlight maybe the top three events in the night sky that we can look forward to this year?
Of course, and we start again with the moon. So there will be a total lunar eclipse, right? Only in a very short time. It's on January 21st. It starts at 4:41 GMT, and the totality lasts until 5:44 GMT. So for about an hour, the moon will be completely eclipsed by the shadow of the Earth. And a nice part about a lunar eclipse is it's always visible from from at least half of the Earth, that means all that part of the Earth that has the moon above the horizon. And for this eclipse, all observers in most parts of Europe, in West Africa, in all the Americas, in Greenland, in the Atlantic, and in the Eastern Pacific Ocean will be able to enjoy this only total lunar eclipse of the year. Again, it starts at 4:41 GMT and lasts until 5:44 GMT. That's totality. During this time, the moon is not completely black, but you see it in a, well, reddish color because some sunlight is bent by the Earth's atmosphere into the shadow of the Earth, so that's why the moon will not going to disappear completely. And for about an hour before totality and an hour after totality, we have the partial phase when the moon is at least in part in the shadow of the Earth.
So on January 21st, we will be hoping here in Germany for clear skies, which doesn't always happen in this part of Germany.
Clear sky, it will be in Germany, it will be early in the morning, so it's not like the famous eclipse we had last year when people were in the summer in July, just late in the evening, have a party in the garden and watch for this famous eclipse with Mars just next to it when it was very bright. So this is a very early morning eclipse for people have to race quite early.
Okay, so what's number two on your list of top events?
Number two, that's the one I'm very excited about. That is the total solar eclipse happening on July the 2nd. So that means for at most 4 minutes and 38 seconds, the moon is blocking the sun completely. So we have a total solar eclipse. It means for about 4.5 minutes, the day turns into night. So we will see the brightest star in the sky. We will see around the black disk of the new moon, we'll see the most beautiful things you can see in the sky. That's the solar atmosphere, the corona, a very nice structure of feathers, of streams. So it's absolutely marvelous. And this is going to happen on July the 2nd. Unfortunately, you have to go on a very narrow strip that extends over more than 10,000 kilometers, but is only about 200 kilometers wide. And the bad part, most of this total solar eclipse is happening just above the Southern Pacific Ocean, and it makes totality makes landfall only in mid-Chile and in Argentina, and so it's going to end in close to Buenos Aires. Totality starts on July the 2nd at 18:02 GMT on the ocean off of New Zealand, and it's going to finish close to Buenos Aires at 20:44 GMT on July the 2nd. I'm going to watch this somewhere in Chile, and it will be my total solar eclipse number 15. So I'm really an addict to total solar eclipses.
I wish you a wonderful trip to Chile in advance. Number three, Dirk, on your list.
And number three, I think it's something everybody can see from every part of the world, so you don't need to travel for that. So we have the two biggest planets in our solar system, so the two big brothers of Earth, Jupiter and Saturn, and they are extremely nice in the sky. So the giant planet Jupiter has its closest approach to Earth on June the 10th. And Saturn is following just 1 month later on July the 9th. And that means from April all the way out to October, we're going to see Jupiter and Saturn in the sky. And so that means on the Northern Hemisphere, we have two nice spots in the short summer nights, but it's extremely nice for all the people living on the Southern Hemisphere. That means guys from South Africa, somewhere in South America, Australia, will have the two major planets of the solar system, the two biggest planets of the solar system in the long winter nights. That's really marvelous. So Jupiter and Saturn, they are the planets of the year.
Okay, so Jupiter, Saturn, a lunar eclipse, a solar eclipse, and an Indian mission to the moon. Dirk Lorenzen, thank you so much for talking to us, and again, a very nice trip to the Southern Hemisphere for the solar eclipse. Well, that is it for this week's Spectrum. Thank you for listening in, and I really do hope that you've gotten some information out of this, that some of you out there, some of our listeners, will be looking up into the night sky in 2019 in a very different way, hopefully seeing some very cool stuff up there, or maybe considering participating in one of your country's national health surveys, getting examined and helping all of us around the world through that data, through that science, or that you might be considering eating some lab-grown meat in the future. And we'd love to hear from you. We are spectrum@dw.com. I would love to hear whether or not you actually would eat some lab-grown meat, or if you find the whole prospect disgusting or something in between. Please write in. We read those emails and we would love to respond to you. If you'd like more information, for example, on that subject, dw.com/science, we have an article on lab-grown meat, more information in that article than we could pack into this radio broadcast. A lot more stuff online as well. We're also on Twitter. We are DW_SciTech. We are on Facebook called DW Science. And again, thank you to all of you for listening in. Thank you to my sound technician today, Gert Georgi. And from all of us here at Deutsche Welle, have a wonderful week ahead.